This weekend starts right after this. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning with your host, Gordon Deal.
Privacy trade-offs. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your Mother's Day weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
When employees return to the office and customers return to stores, what kind of privacy issues will they face with things like cameras that detect fevers?
The stay-at-home orders are giving scientists a rare opportunity to study dissipating pollution.
On this Mother's Day weekend, tips on how to celebrate when you have to keep a distance from mom.
And how the pandemic is locking down dreams of high school athletes like basketball standout Jordan Montgomery in Southern California.
He was looking toward the spring and a chance to showcase his abilities to nail down a scholarship, and I think we're talking about thousands of kids across the country, seniors in high school, looking at this career as a chance to finally, I guess, firm up and secure a scholarship, and it's not going to happen now, as we know, with a pandemic that's shut down the sports world.
Josh Peter at USA Today on the impact of the coronavirus restrictions on aspiring college athletes. Well, far from being the unifying force other catastrophes have been, the COVID-19 pandemic is tearing a divided America further apart. In-depth analysis now from Brian Walsh, the future correspondent at Axios, covering topics like emerging tech and geopolitical trends. Brian, how do you see it?
When you see the way that this feels like something that should bring us all together, right? This is a global disaster, it's a national disaster, but the reality is, everyone's experiencing it differently. You know, here where I live in New York City, obviously we've been the epicenter for some time. We know what's happening here. We can feel it. But, you know, elsewhere that's less the case. That doesn't mean they're not going to be, you know, under threat in the future. But it's entirely possible to look at that and say, like, well, this isn't such a big deal, so why are we suffering all this economic problems? And then you add in the fact that, you know, social media, tech platforms today essentially allow you to kind of pick your own reality when it comes to what kind of news or media you want to consume. The result is we're all looking at this in a different way. And because, you know, it demands a lot of us. Instead of coming together, you know, we often find ourselves going in separate directions, and you got bad actors, I think, really capitalizing on this as well. The end result is this is going to end up fracturing us even more than we already were.
You made me think, as you were talking about that, what percentage of us see this maybe as a dividing issue versus a unifying one?
I don't know if I've seen that specifically. I mean, when you look at the way that how you view this pandemic really comes down to a large extent to your party affiliation, you know, Republicans just see it vastly different than Democrats. And some of that might, again, come down to where you are in the country, what you personally experience. But a lot of it comes down now to the fact that we do view things increasingly through a partisan lens. Yeah. And so much of that's often you're negatively sort of identifying yourself based off the people you think you oppose. So, okay, if the Democrats say this is a big deal, this pandemic is a big deal, then maybe Republican-leaning voters are going to say, well, no, it's not, and the president's kind of waffling on that a little bit, and then vice versa as well. The end result being, again, you don't see the same reality.
Even the reported number of deaths, as you point out, is a point of debate.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you think that'd be one thing we can definitely agree on, because deaths are the easiest thing to keep track of, sadly, even compared to the number of cases, for instance. And yet we're seeing that, Democrats tend to think it's underreported. Republicans tend to think it's overreported. The president himself has been wondering if it's overreported. And if you can't agree on something as simple as that, that doesn't really, I think look good for the ability for us to think, okay, what are we going to do down the line in the future when we're trying to predict things? And that's always going to be uncertain. Mm.
We're speaking with Brian Walsh. He's the future correspondent at Axios. His piece is called Why the Coronavirus Tears Us Apart. One of the other points you made, too, you said even within hard-hit cities, the experience often breaks down along lines of race and class. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you see, it's such an unusually high percentage of minorities suffering more heavily from this disease, higher case numbers based off their percentage of the population, higher numbers of deaths, ditto with people who are poor. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with, it might be the kind of jobs you're doing. Are you an essential worker? That means you still have to go to the workforce, which means you might be being exposed. Do you have to ride transit in certain cities? Are you just not getting as good health care? Were you not in as good health before this, all of which means, again, this is not something that presents us with an equal risk, but it really depends, again, on where you live in the country, what your background is, what your daily life is like. So, again, it's not like we can all look at that and say, like, we're in this together, because in a sense, we're not quite in the same way.
I explain the point you made, too, about how the story of COVID-19 has largely been told secondhand compared to other disasters.
Yeah, this has really struck me for a couple of times. You know, I've been a reporter for more than 20 years now, reported through, you know, big events like 9/11, you know, through wars, through other pandemics. And you think of all of those events, I think Hurricane Katrina, they have their characteristic images. It might be a photograph. It might be, you know, video that someone did where you can actually see it happen. You can see the floods. You can see the earthquake. You can see the war itself. But here you can't. You know, the real catastrophe that's happening is all happening behind hospital doors. And because of patient privacy laws, we can't really go in there as journalists. You know, for safety reasons, because of risk of infection, we can't really go in there. And so as a result, you know, there's nothing to see. I mean, the dominant images here are, you know, empty streets or people in masks or closed businesses, but you don't see the people dying and suffering. And I think that makes it easier to treat it as unreal if that's, you know, sort of the way you want to go.
Does the lack of unity here hurt us?
Oh, yeah, I think absolutely. You know, I mean, I think it hurts us in a lot of different areas, but, you know, ultimately we're going to need to do most likely more sacrifice in the future. We're going to need to figure out how we help the 30 million plus people out of work, but we also have to figure out how do we ensure that as few Americans suffer this disease and die as possible. That's going to mean hard choices, and hard choices are a lot easier to make, we know this from history, if you have a unified public behind you.
Thanks, Brian. Brian Walsh, the future correspondent at Axios. It's 12 minutes now after the hour on this weekend.
We're all in uncharted territory, looking for ways to support our communities. At Dell Technologies, we're making sure small businesses have the right tech solutions. Dell Technologies advisors are here for you, from helping small businesses stay connected and productive while working remotely with Windows 10 and Microsoft Teams, to rapidly deploying remote work solutions that limit upfront costs with Dell Financial Services. We're standing by you every step of the way. Call 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL.
Hey, thanks for spending time with us. As communities and businesses across the country begin to reopen, more people are weighing whether and how they should head into work and perhaps visit restaurants, retail shops, and hair salons. Andrea Peterson, reporter at the Wall Street Journal, has been collecting best practice guidance from public health experts. Andrea, who's saying what?
The National Restaurant Association is actually, they've released a kind of reopening guidance that includes, you know, certain recommendations that some will sound fairly familiar, you know, spacing tables at least 6 feet apart, providing hand sanitizer for customers, and also eliminating things like lemons and unwrapped straws from self-service drink stations. Mm. But a professor, Benjamin Chapman, who's a professor of food safety at North Carolina State, he was actually a co-author of these restaurant recommendations. I spoke to him, and he told me that the biggest risk in restaurants is actually other people. So you really want to avoid any crowds, whether it's, you know, waiting for a table or, you know, people sort of standing around at the bar. And also, outdoor dining is going to be safer than indoor dining, simply because there's going to be more ventilation and airflow, and that can actually help reduce the number of virus particles per volume of air. The things you need to be wary about are what he calls high-touch surfaces, which are things like menus and salt and pepper shakers, pens, those little leather holders that wait staff often use to present your check. Using hand sanitizer, washing your hands for at least 20 seconds, those are really important whenever you're going to be handling something like that. Experts say there's no evidence that you can get the virus by eating it in cooked food.
Okay.
So that's something that people should be a little, you know, heartened by. But also that the things like cutlery, like the, you know, forks and knives and glasses, those things, he said, are less worrisome because they're likely only handled by wait staff and staffers who are trained in food safety and who've really been through these safety protocols. So it's more the things that could be touched by other patrons.
Wow.
You know,
yeah.
Restaurants should be using paper menus that are thrown away after every patron, or they should be disinfecting menus between customers. But he said that actually the safest thing of all is to avoid any of those menus at all, and actually look up the menu on the restaurant's website. You can even, you know, oftentimes restaurants are actually allowing you to order online as well, so you don't even have to deal with payment afterward. So anything you can do to sort of limit your handling of these high-touch items is safest.
We're speaking with Andrea Peterson, health reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Her piece is called Safety Advice for Reopening, How to Reduce Your Risks as Coronavirus Lockdowns Ease. I don't want to harp on restaurants, but you know, suddenly if I'm bringing up the menu on my phone, or you know, the server's wearing a mask and you know, you're seated every other table, I feel like there's just no ambiance. I'd rather just, I think, get takeout and bring it home.
I'm sure that there are definitely going to be people who feel that way. And so that's certainly the safest, probably, you know, safer option is to pick it up and take it home. You're going to limit your exposure to other people, which is the biggest risk of being in a restaurant.
How about for getting to work? Because the folks in the cities that have to, say, hop on a subway, as one guy in your story described it, it's just a petri dish.
Yes, that's true. Because the problem with commuting on a bus or a train is that it's very hard to have enough distance between, if the train or bus is crowded, it's hard to have enough distance between passengers. So that's, you know, if you have to take public transportation, wear a face mask, and also be really cautious about hand hygiene, was what one expert told me. You use hand sanitizer, wash hands with soap and water for at least 20 seconds, avoid touching your face, all those things that kind of have been drilled into us now. Walking or biking to work or driving your own car are going to be the safest options. If you have the money to do so, taking a taxi or using an Uber or Lyft is also generally less risky than public transportation, particularly if the driver is wearing a mask. Because as people probably know, if an infectious person is wearing a mask, the mask will trap the respiratory droplets that are emitted when coughing, sneezing, or exhaling that contain the virus.
Yeah.
So one expert told me that actually those old school plexiglass shields in some taxis would also provide some protection, and also open the car windows if you're in an Uber or a Lyft or a taxi.
Thanks, Andrea. Andrea Peterson, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. 21 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Even in tough times, you want to try to look your best, even if it's just from the waist up for those video chats. So when it comes to your facial hair, Harry's has you covered, bringing you incredibly high-quality blades at factory direct prices, just $2 per blade. Now, when it comes to my facial hair, I'm typically a goatee guy, but lately I've been using these times of home quarantine to experiment with a full beard. This has allowed the precision trimmer blade on my Harry's razor to take center stage. I use it to make sure my new beard is looking its best. Now, you can keep your face looking smooth, too, or your beard looking clean, with a Harry's trial set delivered right to your doorstep. Just go to harrys.com/Gordon to order yours. And get this, to help support those who need it the most right now, Harry's is donating $1 million worth of shaving supplies to hospitals across the U.S. so you can feel good about looking good. Listeners of our show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/Gordon. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, a 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/Gordon to start shaving better today. Thanks for being with us. A survey by the Harris Poll on behalf of TD Ameritrade shows competitive athletes ages 15 to 29 and parents have seen their plans upended by the coronavirus pandemic. Among the findings, almost 20% say their scholarships have been delayed or canceled. More from this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
The pandemic hasn't only affected students already in school. It's affecting a lot of students trying to get in schools. And that means athletes who are counting on scholarships this spring. Josh Peter of USA Today has taken a look at this dilemma facing many young athletes and their families and joins us now. Josh, who did you talk to?
I talked to quite a few people, in particular a young man named Jordan Montgomery, a point guard out of Murrieta, California, not too far from Los Angeles. And his story, I think, really exemplified the stories of many in that he was looking toward the spring and a chance to showcase his abilities to nail down a scholarship. And I think we're talking about thousands of kids across the country, seniors in high school, looking at this for as a chance to finally I guess, firm up or secure a scholarship. And it's not going to happen now, as we know, where the pandemic has shut down the sports world. And so it's been a difficult time for those kids and their families.
How have those kids been trying to grab the attention of schools?
Well, because they don't have a chance to compete, there are some apps and sites online where they can post videos and post stats, and it's not ideal. I mean, most coaches want to scout kids in person. It's just, it's different to see someone live than to see tape. But without a chance to compete in these spring showcases or seasons, for that matter, softball in particular, it's just difficult to convince a coach that you've got what it takes to compete at that level.
Josh, on the flip side of that, how are coaches able to recruit in this environment?
Well, I didn't talk to many coaches directly. I focused more on the perspective of the kids and their families. But what the coaches will likely do now is look for college transfers, graduate transfers, kids who already have tape, kids where they can see how they competed at the college level. So that's the problem for the high school kids. I mean, the college transfers are out there. They've got a body of work showing how they perform against other college athletes. The high school players might be superior, but you just don't have that tape to see how they fare, how they perform against other college athletes. So they're at a significant disadvantage that way.
We're speaking with Josh Peter of USA Today about the dilemma facing many high school athletes who are trying to take the next step and get into college. Have schools actually pulled scholarships that were promised to some of these high school kids?
I think the more common case is Division II schools holding off on offering a full scholarship and asking kids to wait. The schools now are facing financial challenges and just aren't clear about what they can afford and what they can offer. And so it's just a wait-and-see game. Division I schools, I haven't heard of any big-time schools that are canceling or withdrawing. I think it's mostly the smaller schools that just can't act as soon as they're used to acting. And just kids are on hold. You know, they don't know whether or not they get the full ride they expected, or their parents or the families are going to have to come up with another $10,000, $15,000 to cover the gap.
Josh, is there any recourse for students who lose scholarship money?
I haven't heard of any. It's a great question. Whether or not you can appeal to the school, I'm not sure. I don't know of any, you know, process that's in place for that type of situation. I don't think it happens very often. I think more than pulling a scholarship, what you'll see is schools withdraw an offer, and those are informal. Jordan Montgomery, we'd love to have you come to Loyola Marymount, but we're not ready to give you the scholarship papers. And so here he is months later with the coach having left, parted ways, was basically let go, and no scholarship papers in hand. So rather than someone actually having signed the papers and the school withdrawing their commitment, I think that's highly unusual. I think the more common situation is, well, I was offered the scholarship and now the offer's been pulled. So I think that's probably much more common right now.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with USA Today sports reporter Josh Peter. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Let me tell you about my new favorite way to pass the time while commuting. It's the app called Blinkist. Blinkist works on your phone, your tablet, or your web browser. Blinkist takes the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books and whittles it down to just 15 minutes. Successful people like business leaders are well known for reading self-improvement books. I just finished listening to Snowball, a Warren Buffett biography. Listen to Blinkist while commuting or maybe exercising, even while you're waiting for your kids to finish practice. Blinkist has the latest titles from bestseller lists as well as the classic nonfiction titles you always meant to read. I also like listening to some of the history titles since I never had much good history in school. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/morning to try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/morning to start your free 7-day trial. You'll also save 25%, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/morning. Thanks for spending part of your Mother's Day weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka coming up this half hour, using quality quarantine time to talk family finances. Also, how the coronavirus offers a clear view of what causes air pollution and ways to celebrate Mother's Day when you're in lockdown. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. As governments around the world consider how to monitor new coronavirus outbreaks while reopening their societies, many are starting to bet on smartphone apps and other technologies to help slow the pandemic. What's that mean for our privacy? Analysis from Rob Enderle, principal and founder of The Enderle Group. Rob, how do you see it?
Well, to get our hands around the virus and get to a point where we can go back to work, we either need an antivirus that works, and there may not be one. There's a lot of work to try to get something out the door, but remember, we really haven't had an effective antiviral for colds, and we never came up with one for SARS, and that's a related virus. So there's at least a reasonable chance we may not be able to come up with this one, or it might be like the flu, and it looks like that the COVID-19 has begun to mutate, where you take a shot and figure out which version of the flu is going to be out there. You take your shot, and if you get it right, only 10,000 people die, and if you get it wrong, more like 60,000 people die. That's probably not going to make us terribly comfortable with going back to work. But if we can track and trace, if we can figure out where somebody got infected, and if it's somebody that is not showing symptoms, then we can quarantine those folks, and then we can stop the spread. And that can limit dramatically the number of people that die for every virus outbreak. And given the fact we're going to have more viruses like this, mm-hmm. and it would also protect against the flu, we could save an awful lot of lives. But that does mean the systems need to know where we were when we contracted the virus. And that means you've got to be able to track and trace, track the people, trace the spread of the virus. Because, you can remove the active elements from the population, you can pretty much stop a virus spread in its tracks, but you can't unless you can do that, or unless you can get an antivirus to enough people that you get herd immunity.
So as employers and even stores, I guess, do things like check customers and employees for fevers, or we run tracing apps and we try to find out who we might have been in contact with. I mean, explain some of the privacy issues that we're going to come up against.
They have to know, who you are, where you are, and who you came in contact with. That's pretty invasive. And more important, if somebody does get sick, ideally the system would be able to almost instantly trace back where the common elements are for other people that might have gotten sick in the same area, so you can find the person that's spreading the virus and remove them from the population, because that's what it is. You have these super spreaders, people that are not showing symptoms, and they're just going around spreading the virus to everybody that they touch or get too close and talk to. And if you can't remove them from the population, then you get these huge spikes of deaths, because they're just, infected. You got 100 of these guys infecting thousands of people. And so that means it does have to be very, very invasive. You to make this work, and to make it work as fast as it needs to work, you're pretty much on camera the entire, effectively digital camera, digital tracking the entire time. So if you're doing stuff you shouldn't be doing, this also would be admissible to court as part of evidence. And certainly if, your spouse, if you were tracking your kids, those would be all adjuncts to the use of this technology that you might be uncomfortable with.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, principal and founder of The Enderle Group. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for spending part of your Mother's Day weekend with us. Stuck at home with our families, we're chatting more with each other, right? While also frequently touching base with friends and family whom we can't see in person. How about devoting some of these conversations to money? Here are the how and why from personal finance expert Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, help us out.
So, yeah, we're all stuck at home. We're all talking, with our kids, with our parents more than ever because we have all this extra time on our hands. And so what I'd say is use some of that time to talk about money. And you can really think about this as financial self-defense, because the fact is, if your parents get in trouble financially, if your kids grow up to be financially irresponsible adults, don't kid yourself. you're going to ride to the rescue. So if you want to make sure there aren't problems down the road, have the conversations early on. Make sure your parents are in good financial shape. Make sure your kids understand the basics of managing money.
And you know what? To your point, we will ride to the rescue, and it probably will have been our fault for not having taught them, right? Because they're not getting it in school.
No, there's very little personal finance taught, you know, through grade school. And the thing about these conversations is, you know, it can't be lectures. If you lecture your kids, they are just going to tune you right out. Mm-hmm. Instead, it needs to be a conversation that happens over time, you know, at dinner once in a while. And it should be really driven by stories, because we are much more responsive to stories than we are to lectures or to statistics. So you need to talk about what you're doing with your own money. Talk about the financial mistakes you made. Talk about what it was like when you first got into the workforce and you were struggling to make ends meet. And if you do that, your kids will listen and it will sink in.
Yeah. What about that always awkward conversation with parents? It's easy with kids, as you have pointed out, you're the authority figure, but not so much when you have to talk to the parents.
It's really tough to talk to your parents about their finances, but as they head into retirement and as they get older, it's really crucial that you do it. And there are two things I would say on this. First, you know, a great way to open up the conversation is to talk about what you're doing, what you've done with your estate plan, what you're doing to prepare for retirement, and then they'll give you the opportunity to ask your parents, hey, does that sound like a smart thing to do? What have you done? And the second thing, and this becomes particularly important as your parents get into their late 70s and into their 80s, is as we grow older, we have this sense that we're losing control of our lives. You know, we're not able to get us around as well. We don't remember as well. And so if you come on too strong, it's going to feel to your parents like you're trying to take even more control away from them. So what you want to do is say to them, hey, you know, I gather, you know, you're having trouble, you know, going to the grocery store, you know, getting around. What is it that I can do to help you maintain your independence? That is the way to frame it up. If you frame it up that way, so they realize you're not trying to take control away from them, they'll be much more receptive to the conversation.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. He's written a piece about using quarantine time at home with the family to talk about money. I was surprised, too, because this did not happen for me growing up. And you're saying, let your teenagers look at your pay stub and at the statements from your bank or 401k.
Hey, kids are never too old for show and tell. And if you show them the mortgage statement, the credit card statement, the investment account statement, it'll make it much more real for them. You know, maybe you show it the first time and they just roll their eyes. Kids have a tendency to do that. But on the second or third time, they might look more closely. They might ask you a few questions about it. And that will put them on the path to becoming financially responsible adults.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
We're all in uncharted territory, looking for ways to support our communities. At Dell Technologies, we're making sure small businesses have the right tech solutions. Dell Technologies advisors are here for you, from helping small businesses stay connected and productive while working remotely with Windows 10 and Microsoft Teams, to rapidly deploying remote work solutions that limit upfront costs with Dell Financial Services. We're standing by you every step of the way. Call 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL.
Thanks for being with us. The coronavirus shutdowns from the government are giving scientists an opportunity they never thought they would have to see what would happen to the planet if the world's economy took a break. The result has been drops in air pollutants, easier breathing for people with respiratory ailments, and consistently clear views of landmarks often obscured by smog, such as the Hollywood sign in Los Angeles. It's a story by Jim Carlton, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Jim, what are you hearing?
Gordon, we all need some good news, and there's actually a silver lining to this coronavirus pandemic, and that's that we have the cleanest air in many parts of the world since World War II, in 70 years. And what's happened basically is, you know, all these shutdowns, people stopped driving, the factories have slowed or stopped, planes aren't flying as much. And the net result is we have this just stunning drop in air pollution levels all over the world.
All right. In what way? Like, how is this stuff measured?
Well, it's measured. You know, NASA does satellite measurements. That's one example, and they measure something called nitrogen dioxide, which is a byproduct of fossil fuel emissions. And satellite data from NASA show that those levels in the northeastern U.S., for example, where you are around New York City and in that area, dropped 30% during just one period in March from the previous four-year average. And then there's a company in San Francisco, where I am, which is called Acclima. They've compiled kind of mobile sensor data from you know, cars and whatnot in the Bay Area. And that shows 31% fall in nitrogen dioxide in the region, 39% for particulate matter such as smoke, and a 41% plunge in soot created by diesel fumes and other human sources. So it's pretty stunning drops all around.
You know, what was interesting, too, you mentioned Acclima doing this study. You said, too, the reductions in air pollution weren't evenly distributed in the San Francisco Bay Area, meaning what?
I've heard a long time about, they call it environmental justice, that people in poor neighborhoods often live in kind of heavily polluted areas. And we can see in West Oakland, for example, that's a community, it's a majority African-American community in the northwest corner of Oakland, California. They saw a drop in human-caused carbon dioxide, CO2. It went down 56% over one of the time periods they compared to 43% for the whole Bay Area. So it went down much more. And that just showed, according to the scientists, that this is an area that was much more heavily polluted.
We're speaking with Jim Carlton, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. His piece is called Coronavirus Offers a Clear View of What Causes Air Pollution. What do environmental activists do with this information now?
Well, they're saying that this is an unprecedented experiment worldwide that, I mean, if you ever wonder what would happen if we turn the world off for a few weeks? Well, now we're getting it. And so you can kind of see that the world, I mean, that the atmosphere rebounds fairly quickly. So they're saying that we should use this as kind of fresh motivation to kind of wean ourselves off fossil fuels and go to alternative sources, which are cleaner. So I think they see, more than anything else, this shows what can be achieved.
All right. So I don't know. Could a proposal be in the works? Like, okay, so every 2 years we take a week or a month off or something like that, clean up the air?
maybe a less disruptive way, but yeah, right. I mean, that might be it.
All right. So what happens now? Anybody promising to do something different or new with this information?
Well, I mean, I think this is definitely going to work its way into policy discussions, and the data is going to be they're going to be looking at this data for years. I mean, this is a field day for climate scientists and whatnot.
Thanks, Jim. Jim Carlton, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being with us. How do you do Mother's Day this weekend while keeping a social distance if you choose? The LA Times has put together some tips. Number one, if you live nearby but can't go inside, organize a family parade outside your mom's house. Go over early and stealthily decorate outside with, say, chalk drawings on the driveway or a special plant. Number two, organize a virtual party with mom using Zoom or some other app that all family members can share. Then ask everyone to share something they appreciate about mom. Number three, get her a digital subscription to, say, a newspaper or a magazine. Number four, if you can safely share a meal, stick around for a few hours. If you can't safely get everyone in the same room, maybe you can all order the same food for pickup or delivery and eat it at the appointed time. Number five, if all you can do is talk, say by computer or phone, then have everybody pour a glass of wine or make some tea and settle in to tell some stories about her childhood and yours. Or number six, when you talk to mom, tell her something about your life today, how you're coping, who your friends are, or what you hope for in the future. Those tips from the LA Times. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.